If you were to ask who the number one trader in Chinese history is, many people might immediately think of several figures, such as Xi Lang, who has recently become quite popular, or Wu Sangui, who once surrendered to the Qing dynasty. But when it comes to modern traders, there's no doubt that everyone would think of Wang Jingwei. Of course, regarding traders, especially those who collaborated with Japan, due to the propaganda in Chinese historical dramas, in our eyes, they are all morally corrupt individuals. They betrayed the country and the nation for their own selfish desires and personal power. This idea is indeed very applicable to most traders in history, but as the greatest trader of modern times, Wang Jingwei's complexity far exceeds our imagination. He may be one of the few high-minded traders. Hello everyone, I'm Duo Fanglian. In this episode, we'll talk about this morally complex figure, the first scholar of the Qing dynasty, Sun Yat-sen's right-hand man, and a failed diplomatic genius. How did Wang Jingwei become a high-minded trader? There's a term circulating online now, called contrast. If we were to say who among historical figures has the most contrast, Wang Jingwei would undoubtedly be the one. Compared to the inherent impression that traitors and national betrayers are low quality and immoral, the early Wang Jingwei was arguably the greatest moral role model on the land of China. And it's no exaggeration to say that in the year 1900, when rebellious figures were flourishing, you would be hard-pressed to find a rebellious figure with a better image than Wang Jingwei. Wang Jingwei's image was so good that he was like a hexagonal warrior. First of all, Wang Jingwei was very highly educated. Wang Jingwei came from a distinguished scholarly family. His grandfather was a scholar from Zhejiang who later served as an advisor to Liu Kunyi, the governor general of Liangzhong. Influenced by this scholarly background, Wang Jingwei was well versed in the four books and five classics, and studied the works of Wang Yangming. Besides his good family background, Wang Jingwei was also very talented, intelligent and studious. He passed the imperial examination at the age of 17, ranking first in Guangzhou Prefecture. As a scholar, Wang Jingwei also wrote many poems, which were significantly different from those of Mao Zedong, who came from a less privileged background. His poems had a distinct classical style, which we will discuss later. Wang's cultural level was reflected not only in his traditional Chinese scholarship but also in modern science. Around the time Wang Jingwei passed the imperial examination, the Qing dynasty had a minor conflict with the Western powers. This directly led to the Eight Nation Alliance's invasion of Beijing. This event deeply affected Wang Jingwei. He realized that traditional scholarship could not save China, so he decisively chose to abandon his studies and go to Japan to study medicine. He wanted to see how Japan, an awakened Eastern nation, transformed from a backward and oppressed country into one of the great powers. With his outstanding learning ability, Wang Jingwei soon obtained a government scholarship to study in Japan. However, this scholarship was from the Qing dynasty. While studying diligently in Japan, Wang Jingwei was also deeply shaken by the events of that year. The Sino-Japanese War shocked Japan, and the whole country was in turmoil. Trains sped by, and newspapers published numerous extra editions. The Japanese people were fighting on land and, having witnessed the defeat of the Russians, who were considered the steamroller of Europe, on the seas, he saw for the first time an Asian country capable of confronting the West in a modern way. At that moment, shame and hope arose simultaneously in his heart. Wang Jingwei quickly completed a two-stage transformation from acknowledging the Qing dynasty to questioning it, and then opposing it. Acting decisively, Wang Jingwei, who was in Japan at the time, quickly found Sun Yat-sen and became a key figure under him. Naturally, Wang Jingwei, full of talent, quickly gained Sun Yat-sen's trust. At the founding meeting of the Tongmenghui Revolutionary Alliance, in 1905, the 22-year-old Wang Jingwei was elected as the head of the propaganda department, responsible for organizing public opinion-related work. In short, Wang Jingwei became Sun Yat-sen's chief propagandist, responsible for waging a propaganda war against the Qing dynasty. After taking office, Wang Jingwei, with his sharp wit, wrote editorials criticizing the Qing dynasty everywhere. Because Wang Jingwei had received both Western and traditional Confucian education, his editorials often had a strong classical style. For example, in his 1905 article on revolution, he began by writing, "When the world is governed by the way, the names of things do not change. When the world is without the way, the names of things should change." While directly expressing his ideas, the article also maintained a balanced and just tone. Of course, Wang Jingwei, deeply influenced by Confucian culture, did not merely pursue Confucian culture in his rhetoric. His governing philosophy was also deeply influenced by it. While advocating for democratic constitutionalism, Wang Jingwei also emphasized establishing the nation on morality, stressing that the Chinese nation should reshape its moral values. For example, in his 1907 article, Revolution and Morality, he wrote, "Revolutionaries should not stain themselves with blood, but should establish the nation with virtue and repay injustice with righteousness. A government without virtue is like, except for weeding without removing the roots. Wang Jingwei himself looked quite good at this time, and his image was also quite good. You can imagine what kind of image Wang Jingwei had in the anti-Qing movement at this time. A Wang Jingwei who was cultured, moral, and charismatic, became a national revolutionary idol and a national moral role model. Was Wang Jingwei's sense of morality at this time faked? Not really. The reason why Wang Jingwei is called a hexagonal warrior in terms of morality is because Wang Jingwei's high morality was not just a disguise in words. Wang Jingwei was a typical example of knowing and acting in accordance with one's beliefs. Why do I say this? This brings us to another well-known action of Wang Jingwei at that time, the assassination attempt. Although Sun Yat-sen's status is very high now, and everyone generally recognizes Sun Yat-sen, there were also disagreements and divisions. Back in the 1900s, Sun Yat-sen's situation was not as good as everyone imagined, because the Qing dynasty had always adhered to the core principle of, I can't beat the foreigners, but I can beat you. It launched heavy attacks on Sun Yat-sen for a long time. Sun Yat-sen's early attempts to subvert the state power from abroad also failed repeatedly. Under the verbal attacks of the royalist faction, who had always disliked the Revolutionary Party, and the propaganda of some Qing dynasty propaganda teams, the Tongmenghui gradually became known as a group of distant revolutionaries in public opinion. Many people criticized Sun Yat-sen and his Tongmenghui for only engaging in offshore revolution, only talking big in Japan, inciting people in China, and sending them to their deaths. In this situation, the reputation of the Revolutionary Party began to plummet, and Sun Yat-sen also. Sun Yat-sen, who was once ridiculed as someone who only issued revolutionary bonds to swindle money, felt a pang of pain when he saw these words. So he decided to do something to save the entire revolutionary cause and the fate of China. Nothing could stop Wang Jingwei. After leaving Sun Yat-sen with the words, a military general takes death as his purpose, but this fire will illuminate the world, and leaving his friend Hu Hanmin with the eight powerful words, I am the star, the army is the government, he resolutely disregarded everyone's advice and returned to China, preparing to do a great and heroic deed. What was this great deed? It was to assassinate Xifeng, the regent at the time. At this time, the emperor after Cixi's death was Puyi, but Puyi was only 3 years old. Even a general who could reach the sun couldn't boast that a three-year-old child could govern the country. Therefore, the actual head of state at the time was Regent Xifeng. Wang Jingwei's assassination attempt on Xifeng was tantamount to assassinating Xi Jinping in China today. Wang Jingwei's plan to assassinate Xifeng was also very simple and crude. He planned to bury a bomb under the Yingling Bridge, where Xifeng passed on his way to work. If all went according to plan, when Xifeng's sedan chair passed over the Yingling Bridge, he would detonate the bomb and kill Xifeng. However, unexpectedly, something unexpected happened. Under the cold Yingling Bridge, Wang Jingwei and his accomplices were burying bombs when they encountered a man suffering from insomnia who was out for a walk. This man saw so many people digging and thought someone had buried a treasure chest there. So, after Wang Jingwei left, he tried to dig it up to see what was inside. When he dug, he found that the box was full of wires, which frightened him. The man immediately turned around and ran, then called the police and informed the Black Guards. Thus, Wang Jingwei's assassination plan was leaked. The next day, the newspapers were filled with reports of an attempted assassination of Prince Xifeng. At this point, Wang Jingwei still had a chance to escape, but his thinking was very simple. I came to assassinate Xifeng. I'm here to be a suicide bomber, and I don't intend to leave alive. Therefore, after the first attempt, Wang Jingwei didn't escape, but instead planned the next assassination attempt. However, after the first failed attempt, Xifeng would certainly be more vigilant. The plan to plant bombs under the Yingding Bridge was definitely unfeasible, so everything had to be replanned. But just as Wang Jingwei was planning his next move, a large number of Black Guards rushed in. Wang Jinwei's hiding place was discovered, and he was captured. The suicidal assassination attempt failed. At this point, Wang Jingwei wasn't too surprised about being captured. When he decided to assassinate Xifeng in Beijing, he had already prepared for death. Therefore, when facing Prince Xifeng's personal interrogation, Wang Jingwei showed no fear. He voluntarily admitted that he was the mastermind. Of course, the other accomplices who participated in the assassination with Wang Jingwei were also not to be trifled with. They all jumped out and said, I am the mastermind, hoping to help Wang Jingwei escape punishment. This confused the Qing dynasty officials. They had seen people vying for credit, but this was the first time they had seen people vying for blame. Originally, according to the law, Wang Jingwei's assassination attempt should have been punished with execution, and even more so, it was a full-scale battle. Wang Xifeng's thoughts at this time were also along the lines of, damn it, you're trying to kill me on my way to work? Then I'll have to kill a few of your family members and give you a feast of death package. Quote, however, Su Qing and Wang Zixin, who were in charge of the interrogation, immediately advised Xifeng, saying, they came here to die. If you really kill them, won't that put us at a disadvantage? Our great Qing dynasty is already very unpopular, Let's not further enrage the people of the world. It would be better to imprison them, sentence them to life imprisonment, and deprive them of their political rights for life. This way, we can appear magnanimous. If you really hate them, if you absolutely must, we can give them liver cancer in prison. That's not impossible either. Quote, therefore, Wang Jingwei, who failed in the assassination attempt and wanted to sacrifice himself for the country, was only thrown into prison. But at this time, Wang Jingwei himself didn't know this. He thought he was going to die. So in prison, he wrote the farewell poem, leading to a piece of land, no longer a young man's head, Liu Dexin's soul shines brightly in the ruined area. The farewell poem written by Wang Jingwei at this time is quite similar to Tan Song's line, I laugh at the sky with a horizontal sword, going or staying, both are acceptable. After this assassination attempt, Wang Jingwei's reputation in the anti-government circle further improved. Furthermore, Wang Jingwei was also very devoted in love. He and his wife Chen Bijun were together for life, and he never had any other romantic scandals. So, we can imagine that Wang Jingwei at this time not only had a very high level of education, but also a high moral character, a good image, and was devoted in his relationships. Crucially, his moral sense wasn't just for show, it was genuine. Wang Jingwei. Below, we will discuss how Wang Jingwei became a rare example of a morally corrupt figure among revolutionaries. Wang Jingwei thus became a revolutionary saint. But how did this revolutionary saint, Wang Jingwei, transform from a moral paragon to a traitor? Was it because Wang Jingwei's moral compass shifted later on? Was it because, like many revolutionaries, he became a power-hungry scoundrel after gaining power? The answer is actually not that Wang Jingwei's moral sense deteriorated after seizing power. He was one of the few politicians who, after gaining power, did not become overly obsessed with it. For example, this was the case with Wang Jingwei during Yuan Shikai's time. After Sun Yat-sen's struggle in the Grand Hall, the fruits of victory were seized by Yuan Shikai, as everyone should know. And what was Wang Jingwei's attitude towards Yuan Shikai, this traitor to democratic constitutionalism? He initially supported him, then opposed him. Wang Jingwei initially held the idea of experimenting with a democratic republic in China, not experimenting with personal power. Therefore, his initial opinion of Yuan Shikai wasn't too negative. After all, when Yuan Shikai seized power, he sang a very appealing tune, also under the banner of a democratic republic. Therefore, Wang Jingwei strongly urged Sun Yat-sen to voluntarily relinquish power for the sake of the overall situation. He believed that although Sun Yat-sen was the president, and he, as Sun Yat-sen's close subordinate, could naturally benefit and get a high-ranking official position, it didn't matter who became president as long as a democratic republic was achieved. His own status and reputation were irrelevant. Therefore, Wang Jingwei was the first to advocate the theory that the success of the republic does not depend on who is in power. Some people might say, why don't you mention that Wang Jingwei initially supported Yuan Shikai? We can see this from Wang Jingwei's subsequent actions. Although Wang Jingwei initially supported Yuan Shikai's presidency, once Yuan Shikai actually became president, Wang Jingwei never hesitated to criticize him. He consistently acted as a critic in various newspapers, steadfastly criticizing Yuan Shikai for being too dictatorial. As a moral figure at the time, Yuan Shikai frequently extended olive branches to him, but Wang Jingwei consistently and resolutely rejected them. Later, with the assassination of Song Zhaoren, Yuan Shikai and Sun Yat-sen completely broke ties, and Yuan Shikai completely dropped his pretense. Wang Jingwei, without hesitation, immediately severed ties with Yuan Shikai, and then went to France, once again engaging in a second revolution from afar. Of course, here we can also see the characteristics of Wang Jingwei after transforming from a revolutionary to a politician. That is, Wang Jingwei was indeed willing to sacrifice his personal interests for the ideal of a democratic republic. Morally, Wang Jingwei was not problematic, but in the Yuan Shikai incident, it also revealed one of Wang Jingwei's weaknesses. He was easily deceived. As long as someone sang a sweet tune and spoke nicely, promising to help him realize his ideal of a democratic republic in China and achieve his ambitions for China, he would easily compromise and be easily taken in. This basically permeated his entire life and also led to his later tragedy. After suffering at the hands of Yuan Shikai, Wang Jingwei didn't learn much. Wang Jingwei soon fell for it a second time, and this time he fell for the Communist Party. The Communist Party was a major force. After Sun Yat-sen's death in 1925, Wang Jingwei became the de facto leader in charge of party affairs, while Chiang Kai-shek became the de facto leader in charge of the military. Chiang Kai-shek and Wang Jingwei formed a dual power structure on the island. Of course, the main difference between the two, besides their roles in internal affairs and military matters, was that they represented the left and right wings of the party, respectively. Wang Jingwei firmly adhered to Sun Yat-sen's idea of cooperating with the communists and assisting them. He even publicly defended the Communist Party, saying, without the workers and peasants, where would the foundation of the revolution come from? Chiang Kai-shek, however, was different. He firmly opposed the Communist Party. Corresponding to Wang Jingwei, Chiang Kai-shek also had a saying, Japan can only harm our physical bodies, but communism can endanger our souls. Chiang Kai-shek never trusted the Communist Party from the beginning, always considering them his number one enemy, even before the warlords and the Japanese. Chiang Kai-shek also repeatedly put forward the Red Theory, saying that the Soviet Communist Party was trying to use the Chinese Communist Party to turn China into a Soviet colony, rather than genuinely helping them fight the warlords and achieve the three principles of the people. Chiang Kai-shek's statement can be said to have hit the essence of the Communist Party, but obviously, he didn't fully understand this. Therefore, when Chiang Kai-shek repeatedly proposed the theory of prioritizing the suppression of the communists, Wang Jingwei was the first to stand up against it. Wang Jingwei, who had already been brainwashed by the Communist Party, insisted that the Communist Party could be cooperated with, and that the most important thing was for everyone to work together to drive out the warlords and achieve a unified government. Of course, Wang Jingwei's naivety and his views on communism, the party's boundless tolerance also caused Wang Jingwei's prestige within the party to plummet rapidly. By March 20, 1926, just a year after Sun Yat-sen's death, Chiang Kai-shek, taking advantage of Wang Jingwei's illness, launched the Zhongshan incident. This move suppressed the Communist Party's influence within the party and simultaneously weakened Wang Jingwei's power. At this time, Wang Jingwei realized that not many people in the party supported him. He also decided not to fight Chiang Kai-shek for power, prioritizing the realization of the three principles of the people and a democratic republic. In order to avoid further splitting the Kuomintang, he chose to trust Chiang Kai-shek. Since things had come to this point, and everyone was so unhappy with him, he decided not to stand in the way and disrupt unity. He would withdraw, saying, "I'm still a good comrade. Everyone can follow him from now on." Quote. Therefore, after the Zhongshan incident, Wang Jingwei, under the pretext of recuperating from illness, once again went to France. However, not long after arriving in France, Wang Jingwei realized that things were not right. After he left, Chiang Kai-shek frequently launched brutal attacks on the Communist Party members within the party. Finally, under the instigation of the Soviet Communist Party, Wang Jingwei returned to China. To protect his communist comrades, Wang Jingwei established the Wuhan National Government, which included the Communist Party, in Wuhan, confronting Chiang Kai-shek's Nanjing government. However, after returning to China, Wang Jingwei quickly realized that something was wrong. He discovered the true nature of being deceived. Against the backdrop of the KMT-CCP split, Chiang Kai-shek stopped pretending, and the Communist Party also stopped pretending. Wang Jingwei, who established a separate Kuomintang Central Committee in Wuhan, saw that the Communist Party members were no longer talking about KMT-CCP cooperation and contributing to the Republic, but instead began to openly declare that the Kuomintang was nothing more than, it was merely a transitional tool, the three principles of the people were merely a transitional tool, and the Republican system was merely a transitional tool. However, at this time, Wang Jingwei still harbored illusions about the CCP, attempting to balance the situation through negotiation. On the one hand, he advised Chiang Kai-shek not to rush into a split, and on the other hand, he wrote to the CCP representatives to restrain their actions and abide by the agreement they had made with Sun Yat-sen. However, in June 1927, a secret directive from Moscow completely shattered Wang Jingwei's illusions. This decree from Moscow demanded that the Chinese Communist Party immediately launch a land revolution, build its own army, establish revolutionary courts, and completely break with the Kuomintang officers. What angered him was that when the Comintern representative, Roy, personally handed him this telegram, he also threatened Wang Jingwei, saying, "You must comply, otherwise the Soviet Communist Party will sever all ties with you, and all support will cease." When Wang Jingwei saw this order, he was shocked. He suddenly understood Chiang Kai-shek's concerns. Wang Jingwei finally realized that the Communist Party was not what he had imagined, and for the first time, he saw the ugly face of the Communist Party and realized that the Communist Party was essentially a Trojan horse sent by the Soviet Communist Party into the Kuomintang. After recognizing the true nature of the Communist Party, Wang Jingwei's attitude towards the Communist Party underwent a 180-degree turn, just like his attitude towards Yuan Shikai before. In mid-July, he immediately convened a meeting in Wuhan. At the meeting, Wang Jingwei's attitude towards the Communist Party changed drastically. He personally proposed banning the Communist Party and personally signed a circular announcing a complete break between the Communist Party and the Kuomintang. At the same time, he ordered the arrest of Communist Party members and the closure of party headquarters and newspaper management. He hunted down and fought alongside comrades who had fought with him during the war against Japan. This anti-communist fervor of Wang Jingwei continued throughout his life. Of course, due to the comprehensive pressure from the Communist Party, Wang Jingwei temporarily put aside his conflict with Chiang Kai-shek and cooperated with him again, since their main conflict before was over the Communist Party. However, after Wang Jingwei suffered setbacks from both Yuan Shikai and the Communist Party, his political maturity did not improve. The saying, "a different trick every day," perfectly suited Wang Jingwei. Wang Jingwei soon encountered his next scheme, one that completely deceived him and left him utterly confused, Japan. After the September 18th incident in 1931, Japan began its attempt to conquer China. Wang Jingwei's early attitude towards Japan was one of clear opposition. That year, after the fall of Northeast China, Zhang Xueliang, without firing a single shot, ran back to the interior like a dog with its tail between its legs. At that time, the entire Chinese nation erupted with unprecedented anti-Japanese fervor, and Wang Jingwei's performance within the government was also very intense. At a meeting, he vehemently advocated moving the capital to Luoyang and fighting Japan to the death, refusing to cede any territory. He even personally presided over the Supreme Military Conference, dividing the country into four defense zones, adopting a stance of absolute determination to retaliate against the Japanese. However, at this time, although Japan had already begun its first round of invasion of China and established the puppet state of Manchukuo, Wang Jingwei and Chiang Kai-shek's stance was still relatively unified. The Communist Party was the most evil, and the Japanese could only rank second. Therefore, the party quickly decided. The slogan was primarily anti-Japanese, but in reality, suppressing the bandits remained the top priority. Resistance against Japan could be put aside for the time being. At this time, Wang Jingwei, who was in charge of diplomacy, began to try to negotiate with the Japanese. However, with the Japanese invasion of China, the Japanese threat was rapidly magnified. When the choice had to be made between suppressing the bandits and resisting the Japanese, Wang Jingwei completely sided with the Japanese. Now, looking at history, we all know that Japan, after establishing Manchukuo, always intended to completely eliminate and colonize China. We all know this now. Yuan Shikai, from the beginning of his power grab, wanted to become emperor, and the Communist Party, after its appearance on Chinese soil, wanted to achieve communism. We also know this. However, these are all our perspectives from hindsight, but it was not necessarily so from Wang Jingwei's perspective at the time. Wang Jingwei's personal experiences further deepened his misjudgment. Both Wang Jingwei and Chiang Kai-shek studied in Japan, but Wang Jingwei studied at a political science and law university, a civilian school, while Chiang Kai-shek studied at a military academy. Therefore, Wang Jingwei's understanding of Japan largely remained within the framework of the Japanese civilian bureaucracy, especially the civilian bureaucracy of the Taisho era in the 1920s. His understanding of Japan was that of a civilized, rule-abiding, and honest Japan, not the militaristic Showa Japan that followed. Therefore, even when Japan launched a full-scale invasion of China, he still believed that negotiations with the Japanese were possible, that it was just a minor misunderstanding, and that the main work remained. However, the focus should be on the payment issue, and it is true that the Japanese civilian government at the time did not support an immediate military campaign against China, especially before the Marco Polo Bridge incident. When the Marco Polo Bridge incident broke out in 1937, the Japanese civilian government, with Prime Minister Kano Fumimaro at its core, was in power. This cabinet didn't necessarily not want to invade China, but at least they didn't want to invade China so quickly. The Marco Polo Bridge incident in 1937 was certainly not part of Kano's plan. The sudden shelling of Wanping by the Japanese army during the Marco Polo Bridge incident was not arranged by Kano. It was a decision advocated by lower-ranking Japanese officers stationed in China at the time, a typical example of a Japanese lower-level initiative, and a typical case of the military hijacking the civilian government. Wang Jingwei deeply understood this principle, so he believed that he could negotiate with Kano Fumimaro. However, it is clear that Wang Jingwei misjudged Kano's intentions. Kano didn't want to invade China so quickly, but he did not want to invade China at all. Since the invasion had already begun, Kano was prepared to go with the flow. Wang Jingwei, who was already thinking of negotiating with Japan, after the outbreak of the full-scale war of resistance in 1937, and after Kano offered a false olive branch, quickly fell for it. What was this olive branch? It was the second statement on China issued by Japanese Prime Minister Kano Fumimaro on October 3, 1938. In the statement, Kano said that Japan had no intention of annexing China, and hoped that China and Japan would jointly seek a new order in Asia and establish lasting peace. This statement was a typical example of a carefully packaged diplomatic maneuver. In Japan, it was used to stabilize the situation internally, while externally deliberately releasing signals of possible negotiations. Facing this statement, Zhang Jieshi, who was consistently politically astute and highly perceptive, was very clear-headed. His reaction after seeing the statement was only a cold laugh. He clearly understood that the words spoken by Wen were nothing more than Japanese psychological warfare, an attempt to use the new order to force China into submission. However, this statement became a trap specifically designed for Wang Jingwei. After hearing the translated version, Wang Jingwei was extremely excited. That night, he first said to Zhou Fohai, who was by his side, "Japan will eventually come to its senses." The naivety of this statement left Zhou Fohai, who later also became a collaborator, speechless. Afterwards, he also told his wife, Chen Bijun, "Japan also has a peace faction. We cannot let Japanese militarism monopolize the discourse. We must unite with the Japanese civilian peace faction to fight against Japanese militarism." Quote, this political idea also permeated Wang Jingwei's actions afterward. After being influenced by Kano Fumimaro, in order to verify whether Japan truly intended to negotiate, Wang Jingwei proactively sent his confidants, Gao Zhongwu and Dao Sheng, to begin contact with Japan. This move was extremely risky at the time, because for several years since the war began, the interaction between China and Japan had not been very friendly. Millions of people were fighting on the front lines every day, and you, as the second in command of the anti-Japanese government, secretly sent people to the enemy's headquarters to negotiate. Aren't you treating Chinese soldiers like fools? Are you worthy of the soldiers who sacrificed their lives on the front lines? Wang Jingwei also admitted, There was indeed an element of gambling involved, but in his view, he won this gamble. Little did he know, however, that this was the next trap laid by the enemy. After Wang Nuwei sent people to the talks, the two sides quickly reached a secret agreement called the Mingdao Chengguang Hall Agreement in a friendly atmosphere. The agreement consisted of six main points. First, China and Japan signed an anti-communist agreement, designating Inner Mongolia as a special anti-communist zone and allowing Japanese troops to be stationed there. Second, China recognized the independence of Manchukuo. Third, Japan abolished extraterritorial rights and returned its concessions in China. Fourth, China agreed to Japan's development of resources in North China and granted it most favored nation treatment. Fifth, Japan did not demand war reparations, but China needed to compensate for the losses of Japanese nationals. Sixth, after the restoration of peace, Japan would withdraw within 2 years. Of course, from the perspective of later generations, we can criticize this agreement as a betrayal of national sovereignty. However, from the perspective of those involved at the time, it was completely different. At that time, the Sino-Japanese War had been going on for more than a year. After the battles in Taiyuan, Wuhan, and other places, Japan had already occupied large areas of China. Most major Chinese cities had fallen, and the areas actually controlled by the Kuomintang, except for large impoverished mountainous areas in the northwest, were basically limited to parts of Zhejiang, Fujian, Guangdong, and Sichuan. At that time, the relatively prosperous and industrially strong northern regions of China were completely occupied. The economic and production system under the Kuomintang was on the verge of collapse. In the view of many at the time, if the war continued like this, the nationalist government might even have to cooperate with the Communist Party. Internationally, the situation was even more unfavorable for China at the time. China was completely isolated, unlike modern-day Ukraine, which has the support of Zelensky, the European Union, and some support from the United States. At that time, the Nine Power Treaty was essentially defunct for China, as everyone was urging China to quickly sign the treaty and resolve the issue through negotiation. At the Nine Power Conference in Brussels, some even spoke favorably of Japan. The only major power that supported China was the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union's support for the Communist Party was inconsistent and unreliable. Sometimes, they not only failed to resist Japan but even colluded with the Japanese, occasionally even attacking the nationalist government. China's situation at that time was infinitely worse than that of present-day Ukraine. Against this backdrop, this treaty actually seemed somewhat appealing. This treaty only required China to acknowledge the independence of Manchukuo, which had already been lost after the Marco Polo Bridge incident, and pay a small amount of reparations, in exchange for the return of a large amount of land currently occupied by the Japanese army, as well as Japan's concessions and extraterritorial rights in China. This is equivalent to saying that for present-day Ukraine, simply acknowledging the independence of Crimea would allow them to regain the Donbass region occupied by Russia, which certainly seems like a good deal. Moreover, the most crucial part of this agreement was a promise that Japan would withdraw its troops within 2 years. As long as the troops withdrew, there would be room for maneuver and negotiation. China is vast and rich in resources. Given time to develop, it could eventually catch up with Japan. However, in addition to the six explicit clauses, there was a hidden condition. Chiang Kai-shek had to step down. Chiang Kai-shek was at the time, in my opinion, he was the biggest obstacle to the East Asian co-prosperity sphere, and he had to be dealt with immediately. At the end of the document, it also stated that they would only negotiate with Wang Jingwei's group, not with Chiang Kai-shek. This made it even more attractive to Wang Jingwei. Although we say that Wang Jingwei wasn't very power-hungry, he didn't want absolutely no power at all. Nobody wants absolutely no power. When Wang Jingwei saw this agreement, he thought, not only can I use this agreement to become the leader of China again, but I can also truly save the country. This is like winning the lottery. Quote, therefore, Wang Jingwei, upon receiving this treaty, was extremely excited. See what I told you? I said the Japanese would negotiate. Quote, at this time, Wang Jingwei naively believed that as long as he could step forward to establish a new nationalist government and reach an agreement with the Japanese, he could restore peace through negotiation, truly achieve a national ceasefire, and save the Chinese nation from suffering. Of course, in Wang Jingwei's view, all of this came at a huge price. His former moral standing would be completely destroyed. After all, China and Japan had been fighting for so many years, the national hatred was undeniable and unchangeable. If he unilaterally signed a peace agreement with Japan, regardless of whether the agreement was fair or the outcome was good, the public would certainly not accept it. But to Wang Jingwei himself, this was merely a self-sacrifice made to achieve the great rejuvenation of the nation. It was a matter of prioritizing the greater good over personal gain. He sacrificed his own morality, losing personal gain, but he preserved the future of the nation, thus achieving the greater good. This point is reflected in Wang Jingwei's final statement to Chiang Kai-shek. This can also be seen in the letter. Wang Jingwei once left a long letter to Chiang Kai-shek, with whom he had cooperated and struggled throughout his life. In the letter, he devoted a large section to explaining his motives and plans for defecting, and at the end of the letter, he said, regarding the military uprising, I acknowledge its difficulty, but what is righteousness, and what is manhood? He separated righteousness and difficulty into two roles in the nation's destiny. Chiang Kai-shek continued to fight on the surface, maintaining the century-old alliance with international powers as righteousness. He, on the other hand, had to do the most undignified thing, bearing the burden of criticism and moral condemnation alone. Achieving peace through negotiation is a difficult task. Although we might find this statement somewhat imaginative, wondering how betraying the country could be described so nobly, this was indeed what Wang Jingwei thought at the time. This was Wang Jingwei's last message, please accept it. After sending the letter, Wang Jingwei quickly began his plan. On December 18, 1938, he first took his family to Kunming. Why did he choose Kunming? Because the initial idea was this. The Japanese wanted to negotiate with the nationalist government, right? So how could I have a better negotiating position in the negotiations? How could I achieve the independence I hoped for? I would first have to build a framework for a new Southwest government in Yunnan. Why in the Yunnan region? Because the Yunnan region had not fallen. After reaching an agreement with you in an unoccupied area, I would then take over your occupied territories, extending the legal system to the original territories. This way, I wouldn't end up like Puyi, becoming your puppet. Because I am a establishing an independent territory served as the foundation for negotiations. The principle was to first establish a non-puppet regime before discussing the recovery of lost territories. This was Wang Jingwei's basic principle from the beginning, and it was also the reason he went to Kunming. However, unforeseen circumstances arose. When he arrived in Kunming, in Yunnan province, and met with Long Yun, the king of Yunnan, and proposed organizing a local government in the southwest to cooperate with Japan in promoting peace talks, both good and bad news arrived. The good news was that Long Yun didn't object. The bad news was that Long Yun didn't agree either. This completely baffled Wang Jingwei. He couldn't figure out what Long Yun was thinking. What if Long Yun didn't listen to his advice and instead arrested him and handed him over to Chiang Kai-shek? Wouldn't his grand plan be ruined? Therefore, after careful consideration, Wang Jingwei decided not to stay any longer. On the 20th, he boarded a plane and flew to Hanoi in French Indochina. He planned to first sign the treaty with the Japanese in Hanoi before discussing subsequent matters. He would wait until the overall situation was settled before trying to persuade Long Yun again. However, as the saying goes, one wrong step leads to many wrong steps. The moment Wang Jingwei's plane landed in Hanoi, French Indochina, accompanied by the unknown sweetness of Japanese promises, Wang began to have no way back. After arriving in Hanoi, Wang Jingwei quickly contacted the Japanese government. Wang Jingwei began his anxious wait, hoping the Japanese would quickly express their stance and begin negotiations with him. The Japanese didn't keep Wang Jingwei waiting for long. Just 2 days after Wang Jingwei arrived in Hanoi, his secretary, Zeng Zhongming, rushed into Wang Jingwei's room, bringing him a message. It was a bolt from the blue. Faced with Wang Jingwei's arrival and statement, Japanese Prime Minister Kano Fumimaro quickly issued his third statement on China. However, this new statement differed significantly from the previous agreement. The content was simplified into 3 points. Japan had no intention of annexing China, Japan had no intention of changing China's political system, and Japan hoped to cooperate with China to jointly combat communism and promote economic development. Wang Jingwei was stunned. This statement seemed mild, but in reality, it was a severe watering down of the secret agreement. In the previous secret contacts, Wang Jingwei had demanded the return of leased territories, the abolition of extraterritorial rights, and, most importantly, that the Japanese must withdraw their troops within 2 years. All of these demands disappeared in this statement, replaced only by vague diplomatic rhetoric and expressions such as cooperation to combat communism and promote economic development. This seemingly conciliatory message actually implied that China must act under Japanese control, and the idea of establishing a puppet regime under Wang Jingwei's name was now clearly evident. After receiving the message, Wang Jingwei was sleepless all night. At this time, he was like a man possessed, repeatedly scrutinizing the words of the statement, hoping to find even a shred of sincerity. In fact, at this point, Wang Jingwei still had a way out. Given his status and position within the party, even if he returned to China immediately, Chiang Kai-shek wouldn't do anything to him. At most, he would just strip him of his power. But at this time, Wang Jingwei, a moral paragon who had been deceived throughout his life, had fallen into a state of self-deception. Wang Jingwei, throughout his life, pursued his moral principles and idealism. In his early years, he could sacrifice his life for it. In his middle years, he could relinquish power for it. For the sake of his moral principles and ideals, he could even abandon fame and reputation. But reality always dealt him heavy blows, especially after his last misjudgment regarding Japan. From then on, our Wang Jingwei began his descent into a tyrannical regime. Facing such a fickle and unpredictable life, every step was a trap for the politically astute Chiang Kai-shek. Of course, even if it wasn't Chiang Kai-shek, any rational person at this time would realize that this statement was a trap. But for Wang Jingwei, it was still a loophole, a stepping stone he could use to his advantage. At this time, Wang Jingwei was like those heartbroken friends who have been deceived by manipulative men and women, frantically scrolling through their phones, checking WeChat messages and moments, trying to find clues in those conversations, deciphering hints, proving that the other person still loves them, proving that the other person still has feelings for them. Wang Jingwei also began a similar self-deception. He constantly reassured himself that the Japanese still wanted to negotiate. But soon, Japanese deception struck again, and Wang Jingwei made a decision that he couldn't turn back from. That was sending a famous telegram. In the last century, since the main means of communication was the telegram, and telegrams were secretly charged by the word, telegraph operators at that time created a code to save money. A different character was used to represent different dates of the month. The character for December 29th was Yan. The telegram sent from Hanoi on that day was therefore called the Yan telegram. Wang Jingwei wanted to send. A telegram was sent in response to the Japanese, attempting to reinterpret Wang Jingwei's statement through this telegram. It aimed to bring Wang Jingwei's statement back to a position he desired, thereby promoting the Sino-Japanese peace talks he wanted. In this telegram, Wang Jingwei expressed his willingness to cooperate with the Japanese and acknowledged their statement. However, in this statement, he supplemented and added to the promises the Japanese had previously made, such as returning leased territories, abolishing extraterritorial rights, promising to maintain China's sovereignty and independence, and supporting the three principles of the people. Wang Jingwei believed that through this telegram, he could bring the Sino-Japanese peace talks back to the version of the Chongguang Agreement. As long as he could return to this version, he would still be victorious. However, he underestimated the Japanese political maneuvering. Within hours of the telegram being sent, a revised version of Wang Jingwei's statement was released. The Asahi Shimbun published a headline on its front page, "Mr. Wang Jingwei advocates Sino-Japanese cooperation," extensively promoting Wang Jingwei's statement. As for the specific content of the telegram, it was completely modified by the Japanese, leaving only the content favorable to them. And what about the demands Wang Jingwei made? They were all deleted. Through a round of media manipulation, Wang Jingwei was completely transformed into a supporter of the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. For Japan, the meaning of this telegram became, "Look, the second in command of the Kuomintang government has unified with us, supporting the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. Our great Japanese empire is going to win." Quote, for China, the meaning of this telegram became, "Even the second in command within your Kuomintang government has decided. We're definitely not fighting anymore. We've decided to surrender to Japan. We've decided to contribute to the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. You should surrender quickly." Quote, such a statement, for the Chinese people at that time, was undoubtedly a complete and utter declaration of treason. Chinese society was in an extreme state of being completely invaded by Japan. The shadow of the Nanjing massacre had not yet dissipated, and before Wuhan and Guangzhou fell, the brutal war across the country had just forged an unprecedented united front. Unless the Chinese people who had been fighting the Japanese for several years were all insignificant, they would never accept such behavior. Under this series of actions, Wang Jingwei was completely branded as a traitor, and his image as a traitor was irrevocably established. In fact, whether it was Wang Jingwei who had gone to Yunnan or Wang Jingwei who had gone to Hanoi, he still had a way back. But after this statement was issued, Wang Jingwei had no way back. At this time, Chiang Kai-shek, who was determined to resist Japan, would absolutely not allow such a serious surrenderist rhetoric to prevail. Chiang Kai-shek also decided to completely sever ties with Wang Jingwei. When Wang Jingwei first defected, he even subtly instructed various regions not to criticize Wang Jingwei's escape, giving him ample room for maneuver and saving face. But after this statement was published, Chiang Kai-shek could no longer consider their past friendship and had to act quickly. First, the Kuomintang internally issued a statement, and shortly after, a meeting was immediately convened to announce the permanent expulsion of Wang Jingwei from all party positions and party membership, a kind of old-fashioned double expulsion. Later, in the spring of 1939, Chiang Kai-shek sent assassins to kill Wang Jingwei, who was in Hanoi. Fortunately, Wang Jingwei swapped beds with his secretary the night before the assassination attempt, resulting in his secretary, Zeng Min, being mistakenly killed, while he narrowly escaped. Of course, at this time, the Communist Party and Mao Zedong also seized the opportunity to gain attention, joining the Kuomintang in condemning Wang Jingwei. Wang Jingwei found himself with nowhere to hide in the vast world. Of course, making one mistake after another, Wang Jingwei, in sorrow and despair, embarked on an even more dangerous path. Having no other choice, Wang Jingwei continued to harbor a glimmer of hope, attempting to contact the Japanese side. Finally, on the morning of May 8, 1939, he boarded a Japanese transport plane bearing the rising sun emblem. The plane flew over the mountains, rivers, and clouds of his hometown in Lingnan, crossed the war-torn southwestern border, and finally landed in Shanghai, the Pearl of the Orient. In the following months after arriving in Shanghai, Wang Jingwei held numerous negotiations with Japanese representatives. The Japanese demanded that Wang Jingwei serve as the leader of a puppet government, as a means for the Japanese to rule China through Chinese proxies. Wang Jingwei agreed to this request, but he also harbored his own illusions. Facing the Japanese demands, he immediately put forward two conditions. First, he demanded that his government, the Nanjing Nationalist Government, control all areas outside of Manchukuo, having control over these areas, at least legally, rather than the Japanese government maintaining legal control over these areas. Only Manchukuo, being independent and not legally belonging to China, was Wang Jingwei's first bottom line, while his second bottom line was that the flag of the Nanjing National Government must be the blue sky and white sun flag, not the Japanese rising sun flag or any other miscellaneous flags. Upon seeing these two so-called bottom lines, the Japanese officials initially thought he was crazy and flatly refused. However, due to Wang Jingwei's insistence, and in order to maintain the appearance of Sino-Japanese cooperation, the Japanese ultimately agreed to his requests, allowing the Nanjing government to symbolically retain the Republic of China's calendar year, allowing the Republic of China to have legal control over these areas, and allowing Wang Jingwei to use the blue sky and white sun flag in the reorganized Nanjing government. However, the Japanese added a small detail to the flag, requiring a small yellow anti-communist flag to be placed on it. This series of negotiations seemed like a sophisticated exchange between Wang Jingwei and the Japanese government, but in reality, Wang Jingwei was merely a self-deceiving puppet. Neither his demands regarding national sovereignty nor his demands regarding the flag could change the fact that Wang Jingwei was merely the head of a puppet government. Despite all this maneuvering, Wang Jingwei finally reached an agreement with the Japanese government on March 30, 1940, and his new Nanjing National Government was formally established. The inauguration ceremony was held in Meiyuan New Village. In the newsreel footage, Wang Jingwei, wearing a long robe and looking solemn, stood between a blue sky and white sun flag and a Japanese national flag. The overall scene looked extremely humiliating, but the most humiliating aspect was actually the nature of the government itself. Although, theoretically, he was the head of the new government, and the structure of the new government included administrative, legislative, judicial, and supervisory branches, a system inherited from the nationalist government, he had virtually no connection with Wang Jingwei anymore. All departments were overseen and controlled by a group of Japanese advisors. This advisory group supervised and monitored the entire Nanjing nationalist government. Its financial, diplomatic, and security powers were completely under Japanese control. The military power of the Wang Jingwei regime was practically non-existent. Nominally, Wang Jingwei's government had hundreds of thousands of Peace and National Salvation Army soldiers, but these were mostly regular troops and local police. All military operations still relied entirely on the Japanese army. Nominally, Wang Jingwei was the chairman, but in reality, his power was systematically undermined. Of course, under these circumstances, Wang Jingwei's mentality underwent some changes. After failing to preserve his independence, he began to look for new justifications for his actions. This time, the justification became the pursuit of a not-so-bad future for China. At this time, he firmly believed that the Axis powers would win World War II, and that his surrender would secure a more advantageous position for China in the New World Order. He also believed he could use delaying tactics to avoid Japanese extortion and maintain some semblance of autonomy for China. This thinking was almost identical to that of the French Marshal Pétain, who led France to surrender to Nazi Germany in just 1 month. Of course, he didn't remain a puppet for very long. Just 4 years later, in 1944, Wang Jingwei died at the Nagoya Imperial Hospital in Japan. Although he died in Japan, Wang Jingwei's last words before his death were still, "I want to return to China." Therefore, according to his will, his body was buried on Meihua Mountain in Nanjing, next to the tomb of his former mentor and comrade in arms, Sun Yat-sen. Currently, his tombstone reads, Wang Jingwei, Chairman of the National Government of the Republic of China. Of course, with the dropping of two atomic bombs on Japan in 1945 and the complete defeat of the Japanese army, the tomb of Wang Jingwei, the number one traitor, was also opened by the nationalist government. After opening the tomb, people discovered that Wang Jingwei was buried wearing a nationalist government civilian official's uniform, and covered with a nationalist party flag with a blue sky and white sun emblem. Even in death, Wang Jingwei still harbored a dream of the Republic of China. Later, Wang Jingwei's body was cremated and thrown into the Yangtze River, and the story of Wang Jingwei came to a complete end. Of course, let's briefly comment on Wang Jingwei's life. The reason why Wang Jingwei is considered different from most traders is that his path to becoming a trader was completely different from that of traditional traders who sought power, fame, or profit. Wang Jingwei certainly pursued power, but power was definitely not the reason he betrayed his country and became a traitor. If he were truly so keen on pursuing power, he would have joined forces with Chiang Kai-shek after Sun Yat-sen's death, instead of waiting until Japan's full-scale invasion of China. Wang Jingwei did indeed spend most of his life pursuing his ideals. Why did Wang Jingwei, who seemed so idealistic and moral, end up like this. This is related to his focus solely on moral pursuits, neglecting practical political considerations. In the era of revolution and warlordism from 1900 to 1949, I believe these revolutionaries and warlords can be broadly divided into three categories. The first category consists of those with no ideals, possessing some political skills, but not very sophisticated ones, such as various warlords like Wu Pifu and Cao Kun. The second category includes those with weak ideals but strong political acumen. Representatives of this group are Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong. Although Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong each championed different ideologies, one communism, the other the three principles of the people, in reality, neither believed in them, knowing they were merely slogans and banners for seizing power. Mao Zedong established a dictatorship after coming to power, and Chiang Kai-shek also established a dictatorship in Taiwan. Both also possessed strong judgment regarding the political situation. Especially when comparing Chiang Kai-shek and Wang Jingwei, the difference is stark. Chiang Kai-shek's judgment of the situation was always far superior to Wang Jingwei's. He saw from the beginning that the Communist Party was problematic and also understood that the Japanese wanted to completely conquer China. Of course, Mao Zedong is even more noteworthy. He not only possessed high political acumen but was also a master of internal power struggles. As for Wang Jingwei, he belongs to the rare third category. He had political ideals, political ambitions, and a high moral standard, but he lacked political acumen. He misjudged and made mistakes at every critical historical juncture, and he also lacked political skill. Wang Jingwei, overall, didn't really resemble a politician. He was more like a poet, a literary figure in the style of Lu Xun. If Wang Jingwei had been assassinated during the assassination attempt at Kaishiko, he would have been a national hero. But unfortunately, history doesn't allow for hypotheticals. He wasn't assassinated, and instead lived until after Sun Yat-sen seized power, and even after Sun Yat-sen's death. After Sun Yat-sen seized power, his role also changed, and he officially stepped onto the political stage. Wang Jingwei completed the transformation from a revolutionary intellectual to a politician, but it was from this transformation that his life began to rapidly decline. Originally, from Wang Jingwei's perspective, the path to achieving a democratic republic in China should have been simple, like leveling up in a game, with the final boss being the Qing government, the regent Xifeng who refused constitutional monarchy. As long as this final boss was defeated, China should have moved towards a democratic republic. But who knew that on this path to achieving a democratic republic in China, the Qing court was only the easiest small monster along the way. After the fall of the Qing dynasty, various powerful figures began to exert their influence on the vast and turbulent land of China. For example, there was Yuan Shikai, various warlords, and later the Communist Party and Mao Zedong, who claimed to support the Republic and the three principles of the people, but were actually establishing a communist dictatorship. Of course, there were also two of the most terrifying enemies, two major forces, foreign powers that China, even with all its national strength, could hardly resist, Japan and the Soviet Union. The further Wang Jingwei went, the less important his abilities became in this struggle. For Wang Jingwei, the tragedy was that if he were simply incompetent, he could have simply faded from the historical stage. However, Wang Jingwei, while lacking ability, also had ideals and the revolutionary prestige inherited from previous revolutionary saints, making him a figure that various ambitious individuals could exploit. The Communist Party wanted to use his prestige to protect itself, while the Japanese wanted to use his prestige to legitimize their puppet government in the Republic of China. Wang's ideals, in turn, became a tool for various ambitious individuals to manipulate and deceive him. This complex situation ultimately led him down a path of complete downfall. However, the cruelty of history lies in the fact that it does not forgive the outcome based on motivation. Regardless of Wang Jingwei's intentions, whether his collaboration with the Japanese was intentional or unintentional, his actions ultimately became a major aid to the Japanese invasion of China. He used his prestige and influence to help the Japanese establish a puppet government, severely weakening the Chinese people's resolve to resist Japan. The label of traitor, in my opinion, is definitely unavoidable. However, he was a traitor with high moral standards, or rather, a foolish and naive traitor, not the morally corrupt traitor that people imagine. Of course, those who have watched the video can also give Wang Jingwei a score. Out of 100 points, how many points do you think such a complex historical figure like Wang Jingwei should receive? Please leave your rating in the comments section. Finally, thank you all for watching today's program. I am Duo Fanglian, and I hope you will like and support my videos so that YouTube will recommend my channel more. See you in the next episode.